For those of you who may be visiting this weekend, our senior pastor, Dudley Rutherford, who's normally up here, is on his planning break where he goes away in the summer, and actually he'll plan out every single sermon for 2022. And he's away doing that. He'll be back in 2 weeks. He'll be back here to kick off a series we have starting in 2 weeks on the Beatitudes. We're continuing our series this week on saints and scoundrels, and I've kind of become the person who introduced our speakers. I'm going to introduce the gentleman who's going to speak today. He actually was an intern back in 1999 here at Shepherd Church. He came out from Missouri. He came out here as on an unpaid internship where, you know, they kind of come to learn. And generally when the internship's over, they go back home because they're not getting paid. Well, this guy just never left. And eventually we started feeling guilty and said, if he's just going to stay here, we need to start paying him. So he came on our staff and worked here for 11 years, worked in many different areas, young adults, then eventually planned one of our first campuses, the one down in Woodland Hills. He planted that campus. Then God called him to Dallas, Texas. So he moved down to Dallas and was a senior pastor of a church down in Dallas. And then he actually eventually came back to California and was the lead pastor out of Discovery Church, another church we planted out in Simi Valley. Then he started doing some writing. He's written several books, two of his best books. One's called Messy Grace. If you've never read it, I highly encourage you in this day and age to read that book. And then he's got a new book releasing this Tuesday called Messy Truth. Just a great writer, great author. But anyway, he's a great friend of ours. And, well, by the way, we hired him again 2 weeks ago. So now he's full-time on our staff once again. His name is Caleb Kaltenbach. Would you please welcome Caleb as he comes to preach for us today?
Hey, how are we doing today? Good? It's kind of the response I was looking for. I mean, we just got done singing songs to God, you know, the creator up here. We don't live in West Virginia. Come on. Yeah, I love Pastor Dudley, I love Pastor Tim. Both of them are just, all the leaders here are great. Like, when they actually talked to me about coming on staff, they said, Caleb, the real reason is we need some more eye candy on our staff. And I said, I'm used to that. I get that all the time. So, absolutely, I'm happy to oblige. So, but seriously, I love this church. If you're new, if this is your first time or second time or you're still checking it out, I'm glad that you're here. I hope that you keep on coming back. This is a place where it's okay not to be okay, but we all join together and we follow Jesus. So you definitely need to come back next week as Pastor Jeff Welling finishes out this series called Saints and Scoundrels. And if you missed any of it, you can check out on our website or on our YouTube channel. But this has been a fantastic series, and I hope that you'll be back next week and you'll check it out and keep on coming back. Give us a chance. You're going to see that everybody else is just as messed up as you are here. And that's really kind of what we're going to talk about today. Okay, so I'm going to start out by making a statement. It's a statement that I'm trying to teach my kids to make. It's a statement that I feel like more and more people need to make. Now, some of you may feel like you're not able to make this statement, but I still think that you should make this statement, okay? I try to make this statement. Are you ready for it? Here it goes, okay? Here we go. I have participated in every bad decision that I have ever made. Yeah, you're not wanting to clap for that one. Some are like, yes, you have, Caleb. You have participated in every bad decision you have made. No, I have participated in every bad decision that I have ever made. And here's what I know about you. You have participated in every bad decision that you have ever made. Now, there are some of you who will say, well, you know, she tricked me or he got me to do this or this or blah, 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 blah. Okay, that's fine. Humans are experts at blaming. I'll get you that. Maybe they helped out. But here's the good news, bad news. God holds you responsible for your decisions. He doesn't hold you responsible for these people's decisions over here. You have participated in every decision that you've ever made. In many instances, if we're going to be honest, I have been the architect of the consequences that I have sat in and experienced. I have participated in every bad decision that I've ever made. This has led me to this conclusion. Again, I think you'll probably agree with me. Human beings do not make good decisions on their own. Like, humans don't. We just don't. And some of you, I can tell, you're pushing back a little bit. Push back. You're free to be wrong, but push back, okay? Have you ever been to LAX? If you ever need to see that people don't make decisions, just go to LAX. When you go to LAX and you see LAX right there, you can see that people do not regularly make good decisions on their own. Case in point, I fly a lot, speak and consult with churches. A couple years ago, I'm in the aisle seat, we're flying, we reach cruising altitude, have this lady sitting next to me, homegirl takes off her shoes and socks and starts clipping her toenails right next to me. And when I say clipping, she's going to town like shards flying everywhere and just, it's just really, really just, you know, like, ugh. And I usually don't say anything, but I just looked at her and I said, really? And she asked, oh, is this bothering you? I said, yes, your toenail is on my shoe. It's usually not there. And she said, well, I guess I could do this when I get home tonight. And I said, let's go with that plan. I'm a big fan. As a matter of fact, that's when I cut my toenails. At nighttime, by myself, not even in front of my wife. She said, I'll have to try that. People don't make good decisions. Now, just so you know, I'll throw myself under the bus too. I'll run myself over with the bus. So you don't think I'm up here just passing out condemnation cards to everybody, okay? I don't drink coffee. I don't. I can already tell I'm being judged by some of you. The reason why I don't drink coffee is I don't like the taste of evil. I have tried to drink coffee. I've tried. I've tried to drink it. I've tried to enjoy it. But I can't, okay? And then I felt guilty. I felt shamed. I felt like it was my fault. And then I realized, no, coffee has been gaslighting me. It's not my fault at all. It's coffee's fault for not being good enough. And so at our house, we'll drink hot tea. And so a few years ago, I'm running late for this meeting, and there's like, my wife has all these different hot teas in front of her and, you know, in the pantry, and she has this new one. I look at the title, and I'm, what is the tea called? And, oh, okay, that's interesting. I take the tea bag, make my tea. It's really good. I have a second cup. I run to work. In the middle of the meeting, I start getting the meat sweats. You know the meat sweats after Thanksgiving dinner where you get done eating and you have to go put on your stretchy pants? My stomach starts gurgling and just everything starts coming up. Like I'm like, what's going on? I run to the bathroom. No kidding. I am there 3.5 or 4 hours. And I'm like, am I sick? What happened? Like, do I have the stomach flu? Is it food poisoning? Then I remembered the name of the tea. It was called Smooth Move. For those of you who are just catching up, and don't feel bad, it's a laxative tea, and I had 2 cups. By the end of 4 hours, I was either praying for God to make it stop or to take me, whichever one came first. I called my wife because I needed somebody to blame. I said, how in the world could you bring Satan's nectar into our house? And she said, well, why didn't you read the instructions? And I said, well, that's not important right now. Let's just be honest. Humans don't make good decisions. And I could give so many different other examples of how people don't make good decisions. I've got plenty to work with over the last 18 months. I've got plenty to work with over the last 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 100, 200, 300 years. Human beings, in and of ourselves, we don't make good decisions. You know why? Because some people call it human nature, trying to make it more palatable. You know what I call it? Sin. In all of us, we have this nasty disease called sin. And we all have it. It is this gravitational pull that all of us have where we want to orient everything toward ourselves, everything towards our benefit. And that's how we function. And that's what we have to fight. And we can't fight that alone. And you look at society right now, is it any wonder that we live in a society that undervalues truth and logic and overemphasizes feelings and reactions? No, because we live in a society filled with people, and people have this gravitational pull towards themselves that they don't want to resist. Is it any wonder that our society is ruled right now by false dichotomies where people think that you don't have an opinion and your opinion doesn't count unless you take an extremist view on one side or the other? Because we keep on giving into this gravitational pull towards ourselves. And here's the deal. That makes us not very good at resisting this nasty thing that we have to deal with our entire lives called temptation. Now, that's what we're going to talk about, okay? Trust me, I don't like talking about temptation. I would rather talk about fasting, and I don't like talking about that either, as you can tell. I like food, and I like Netflix. But we got to talk about temptation. As a matter of fact, the message for this sermon is called The Opportunist. And David, we're talking about this guy named David who is an opportunist. And he was an opportunist in a good way. He's looking for opportunities to be able to help people. But some of the times, that gravitational pull towards self can orient the opportunism inside of us to evil without us even realizing it or knowing it. And so here's what I want to talk about today. What do we do when temptation gets the better of us? What should we remember when we're faced with temptation? Because we're going to take a look at a story in David's life, and out of this story, we're going to get a principle. And I think this principle is going to help you when you're faced with temptation, and it's definitely going to help you when you end up giving into it, and you're like, how do I work my way out of this? So even if you don't go to church on a regular basis, you probably heard about the story that we're going to talk about, David and Bathsheba. I mean, come on. That was TMZ before TMZ. Everybody heard about David and Bathsheba. And so we're going to talk about David and Bathsheba. And before we get there, let me just set the scene for you, okay? David is actually, he is in one of his greatest seasons. David is so excited because the Ark of the Covenant has just been brought into Jerusalem. You know the Ark of the Covenant, right? Moses built it, Indiana Jones found it, right? And the Ark of the Covenant is brought into Jerusalem, and he's dancing. His approval rating is like 99%. And we're joining David in 2 Samuel chapter 11. And a lot of people will say that at the beginning of this, that David is supposed to be out fighting wars with his military. Well, maybe, maybe not. Because on the one side, yeah, I mean, a lot of military kings did go fight with their military during this season, but at the same time, sometimes the battles were too much, and the military wanted to protect the king, so they told the king to stay back. There were other times when the king had to deal with other things here at home. So here's the deal. You're going to have a lot to pile on top of David. You don't need to add this one, but he's hanging out at home. And I'm going to kind of pick up there in 2 Samuel chapter 11. I'm going to read verses 2 through 5. Check this out here. 2 Samuel chapter 11, 2 through 5. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around the roof of the palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "She is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite." Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. Now she was purifying herself from her monthly uncleanliness. Then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David saying, "I am pregnant." Now, let me just set the scene here, and let me kind of unpack this a little bit. And some of you are reading it, you're like, what do you need to unpack, Caleb? It's pretty evident what happened. Here's David, and he's walking around the roof of his house. It says right here in the evening, but the original Hebrew, it really is more like late afternoon. So the sun is still out, and you can see everybody on the roof of their house. David's building was the highest building in Jerusalem. And a lot of the times, people would bathe and take their baths or whatever late afternoon, early evening. What they would do is they would take this bucket of water, they would set it out on top of the roof so that the sun, the hot sun, would just beat down on it all day. And it's just beating down on it. So by the time you get ready to take a bath in the evening, you have warm water or hot water. And so people would naturally take showers, baths, and so on the roof of their house. trusting that their king wasn't a creeper. Walking around, looking at everything, oh, let's see what we have here. Like, seriously, there are some pastors or other people I've talked to, they're like, well, Bathsheba must have known that he would be looking. Really? Like, Bathsheba must have known? You really think that? I mean, everybody else took a shower on the roof of their house. You think that Bathsheba is like, well, if I am right here, the king will see me amongst the other 500 homes around his. It's interesting. There are people that say, well, Bathsheba had just as much responsibility in the matter as the king did. Did she really? Did she? Did she? Here's what I say. No, she didn't. I'm not saying she didn't sin. I'm not saying that. Here's what I am saying. That when you read this, obviously she sinned, but here's the deal. How much time does the biblical author of 2 Samuel spend talking about Bathsheba versus how much time does the biblical author spend talking about David? Hardly says anything about Bathsheba, says a whole lot about David. You know why? Because David was the most powerful person in the room at the time. I digress here, but I'm going to digress on purpose. Hear me out here. I want to ask you a question. Who are you when you have the most power in the room? Who are you when you have the most authority and you have the most influence? How do you treat people? How do you make people feel? What do you say? Do you see people as a chance to leverage them for your benefit, or do you leverage your authority and your power and your influence for the benefit of other people? Who are you? Who do you become when you're the most powerful person in the room? Because at one point or another, we're all get the opportunity several times in our life to be the most powerful person in the room. It could be when we're a parent. It could be when we're a grandparent. It could be when we're in a work meeting. It could be in a church meeting or whatever. It could even be the influence we have in amongst friends. But who you are when you are the most powerful person in the room, when you have the most influence, that says a lot about your character. It also reveals how much you really love God and people, how you leverage the authority and the influence that you have. And what does David do? David sends for her, finds out more about her. The messenger comes back, says, oh, she is Bathsheba, the wife of your soldier, Uriah. This is a chance for David to say, oh, I'm out. She's married. I'm out. I'm married too. I have one wife times 10. That's not what David does. David sends for her. She comes to him and sleeps with him. Now, again, I understand. She made a mistake too. I understand. But at the same time, who's the most powerful person in the room? Because back in those days, I don't know if this is true of King David, but a lot of kings, if you did not do what the king wanted you to do, you know what would happen? I'm not saying David would have done that, but she could have had that fear. And then she has to send word to him that she's pregnant. He doesn't even care enough about her to find out anything. I mean, it's like they just got together once, one night stand, and then, hey, I'm pregnant, and that's the next time that he hears from her. Now, that's another opportunity for him to come clean. I made a mistake. I'm so sorry, I'm a human. I'm sorry that I did that, forgive me. That's not what David does. David sends his messengers to go get Uriah the Hittite, his soldier, and bring him home. And Uriah comes into the palace, and King David is saying, how's the war going? Tell me about how everything's going. And Uriah's got to be like, yeah, everything's going good. Why are you putting your arm around me? Why are you being nice to me? Why didn't you bring one of your generals home? And so, you know, he ends up, you know, giving him some dinner and everything like that. And then we look at 2 Samuel 11, verse 8. Then David said to Uriah, go to your house and wash your feet. And literally in the Hebrew, that doesn't just mean wash your feet. It means get comfortable in almost any way that you can back at your house. And then it says that Uriah left the palace and a gift from the king was sent after him. Probably alcohol. I'm just guessing. If I'm rolling the dice. Verse 9, but Uriah slept at the entrance of the palace with all of his master's servants and did not go down to his house. David was told Uriah did not go home, so he asked Uriah, haven't you just come from a military campaign? Why didn't you go home? Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my commander Joab and my Lord's men are camped in the open country. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and make love to my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing." You see, he wasn't counting on the integrity that Uriah had, because David also broke the law when he took Uriah from the military. He was a good soldier. He put the whole military campaign in jeopardy to try to cover up his own sin. So here's what David does. He says, "Hey, stay one more night." Uriah stays. He gets Uriah drunk. I mean, plastered, okay? But you know what Uriah does? Even though it was illegal for David to do that, it was illegal according to the Old Testament law, Uriah ends up spending the night in the palace again. He has more character drunk than David does sober. And David's supposed to be the person who's closer with God. And so then David, probably counting on the integrity that he's seen in Uriah, writes a note and seals it and gives it to Uriah and says, "Give this to Joab." And so Uriah does. And here's what the note says. Look at 2 Samuel 11:15. "Put Uriah out in front where the fighting is the fiercest, and then withdraw from him so that he will be struck down and die." Again, David sins. He doesn't care about the military, doesn't care about the safety. He cares about covering his own mistake. And Joab does that, and guess what? Uriah dies. And we read in verses 26 to 27, "When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. And after the time of mourning was over, David had her brought to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord." Man, I love that last line. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of, like, if you're watching a streaming series, it's like a cliffhanger episode. "But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord." Hear me out on this real quick. You can hide from people you know. You can even hide from people in your house. You know who you can't hide from? God sees. And what we see some of the times, we think, God's not going to do anything about it. God always does. God cannot allow sin to be undealt with. And God is dealing with sin and injustice even when you and I don't see it. He sees it. And he even sees our sin and our injustice. And so David, he thinks everything's covered. He thinks he's got off scot-clean. I mean, seriously, he thinks, okay, everybody thinks Uriah got her pregnant because Uriah came home. That was a good move on my part. And they're just living life. He didn't expect that God would get involved. What does that say about what he thought God thought about Uriah? And so God tells Nathan what happened and go talk to David. Tell him I'm mad. So this prophet named Nathan goes and confronts David and tells him this story about this guy that has all these sheep, and then there's this one poor guy who has this little lamb, and the guy that has all the sheep wants this little lamb. And he's like, "David, what should we do about this? He stole the lamb, and now this guy has nothing." And David is burning, and he's like, "Oh, we need to kill this guy." He doesn't realize he's being punked divinely. Can you imagine the expression on David's face in 2 Samuel 12:7 when Nathan, I think, probably pointed his finger and said, "You are the man." That must have just struck him right here. And Nathan says, "Hey, God says that he would have given you whatever you wanted if you would have asked." And then he says in verse 11, "This is what the Lord says, out of your own household, I am going to bring calamity on you before your very eyes. I will take your wives and give them to the one who is close to you, and he will sleep with your wives in broad daylight. You did it in secret, but I will do this thing in broad daylight before all Israel." And that's what happened. His son rebelled against him. His son ended up sleeping with David's wives and concubines on a roof in front of everybody. But not only that, God didn't tell him, I'm also going to put it in the Bible and everybody's going to read about it forever. And you'd see that you can understand how difficult this is. And David wishes probably he could have gone back and had a do-over. But hear me out on this. This is what I want you to understand from this story so far. Write this down in the back of your heads. Temptation never keeps its promises. Temptation never keeps its promises. There is no way that temptation will ever give you what it promises. Temptation promises you everything. It promises you shortcuts. It says, hey, you can follow God and do this over here. He's not really serious about that. You know what temptation says? Go ahead and do it again. You've got it this time. Nobody will find out. You're that good to cover it up. You make great decisions. Hear me out on this. Temptation never keeps its promises. I think it was Albert Einstein or some other really smart dude who said that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. But yet, what do we keep on doing again and again and again? Temptation, temptation. I can control it. Nobody's going to find out. If they do, I'm going to be able to explain my way out of it. Hear me out on this. I know this is going to hurt. We're going to end on a good note, by the way, okay? And you'll be out in time to go eat lunch. You'll beat the Lutherans to the buffet. Hear me out on this. You're not that good. You are not that sly. You're not that winsome. You're not that slick. Eventually, truth wins. Truth is revealed. Truth comes out. People will know what happened. Temptation never keeps its promises. And you can see that David is just cut by this. He says in the beginning of verse 13, he says that to Nathan, David says, I have sinned against the Lord. And you can see that it cut him to the bone. And we actually read this in Psalm 51. This is a psalm or a song, a worship song that David wrote about his experience with Bathsheba and Uriah and Nathan and the consequences. Listen to what he says in Psalm 51, verses 1 through 4 and verse 10. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion. Blot out my transgressions. Wash away all my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions and my sin is always before me. Against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. So you are right in your verdict and justified when you judge. Create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Renew a right spirit in me. David knew that he had fallen so far. He's like, God, I cannot restore myself. I have to cling to you for my restoration. I can't do it on my own. As much as I cleaned on you for my salvation, I have to cling on you to restore me. Have you ever been there before? When you realize how far you've fallen, and usually we fall when we are at our most successful point. When we think we're the strongest. The end of verse 13, Nathan replies this, the Lord has taken away your sin. You are not going to die. Hear me out on this. Temptation never keeps its promises, but God is always faithful. Temptation will never keep its promises, but God will always be faithful, period. There's never a time when God will fail to not be faithful. He will always be faithful because when you follow Jesus, he is faithful. No matter what, because if he is faithless to you, he is faithless to himself. If he's unfaithful to you, he's unfaithful to himself. That's what Paul says in 2 Timothy. He cannot disown himself. God is always faithful. Now, hear me out on this. Sometimes God allows us to experience the consequences of our actions, many of the times. Because David had consequences to this. He lost his firstborn son. He had issues with his other kids. The sword never departed from his household. He had to deal with the consequences. There are times when God takes away earthly consequences. That does happen from time to time. When God thinks that that's what's best in the moment. But usually, God allows us to sit in the midst of our consequences out of discipline, not punishment. Punishment wants to destroy and torture. Discipline wants to strengthen your character and faith. But here's the deal. When we follow God, when we follow Jesus, sometimes he allows us to experience the consequences of our actions, but he says that you will not go through those consequences alone. I will walk with you. We will endure them together. Because again, God allows us to be, he does discipline us. He doesn't enjoy it. I have to discipline my 12-year-old and 14-year-old. I don't enjoy it. I take that back. There are a couple times when I do. I gotta be honest, they can be annoying. It's with great pleasure I take away the PlayStation 5. I know that's bad, but I do. There are a couple times where I'm like, you are really annoying me today. I love you, but you're annoying. I don't say that because I'm not a schmuck, but still. See, God loves you. And here's what we believe at this church. We believe that Jesus took away the eternal consequences for our sin. We believe that when he died on the cross, that when you believe in him, all of your sin and shame and guilt and mistakes were placed on him in one moment of time. And the wrath of God was revealed against Jesus when he was hanging on the cross because of what we have done. Then he was placed in the grave. He rose 3 days later. But when he rose to the newness of life, all of our sin and all of our shame and all of the ugliness about us was left in the grave with him, so that we are blameless before God. Another way I say it is like this, that metaphorically, when you believe in Jesus, when he died on the cross, God didn't see Jesus dying on the cross there. God saw you. And now that you live, God doesn't see you live. He sees his son living your life through you. And this is why the Apostle Paul in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 7 wrote, "In Jesus we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins in accordance with the riches of God's grace." This is why the author of Hebrews in Hebrews 9:14 wrote, "How much more then will the blood of Christ, through whom the eternal spirit and offered himself unblemished to God, cleanse our consciousness from acts that lead to death so that we may serve the living God." You see, I believe that Jesus died not only to give you eternal life, not only to give you a connection to the Father, not only to adopt you, but so that you would not live life alone in this world. And so when temptation hits you, and when you need to remember that temptation never keeps its promises, but God is always faithful, and you find yourself dealing with the consequences of what you have done, or dealing with the guilt of trying to hide what you have done, here are four questions I think you need to ask yourself. I try to ask myself. Number one, what do I need to own? Number two, who needs my apology? Number three, who can walk with me? And number four, how can I help others? Number one, what do I need to own? What is it that I'm trying to hide? What is it that I hope nobody else finds out? Number one, what is it that I need to own? Number two, who needs my apology? Because here's the deal. You got to apologize to somebody. And I'm not saying everybody in here does, but some of us do. We owe somebody an apology. You're like, well, Caleb, they're not going to accept it. You let God deal with them. You let God deal with you. You do what you need to do. Let God deal with that person. That's between them and God. You do what you need to do. And there are a lot of us we need to apologize. Well, I don't think I need to apologize. Well, an attitude like that shows me you do. And who can walk with me? Look, I get it. There are a lot of you, you have Christians in your household. I didn't grow up in a Christian household. There are a lot of you who have Christians in your household. But some of you, you need to be around other Christians than just in your household. That's why we push life groups so much in this church. That's why I think you need to be in a life group. Now, I think there are some of you who are introverts, and you're like, oh, I don't know. And where are my introverts at? Yeah, they're not going to say anything. Gotcha. Introverts are not going to say anything. They're like, well, stop talking about me. Right, I get it. Even if you're an introvert, but even introverts, you need community as well. You need people to walk with you who are not in your immediate household, people that you can be real with. We're going to have an opportunity soon for you to join a life group, and you need to do it. Or else I'm going to tell on Pastor Dudley on you, okay? Fourth thing is this, how can I help others? Because God is faithful to you. God wants to leverage what has happened to you for other people. You're not just saved for yourself. You are blessed to be a blessing. You are saved for God to leverage your life to help save other people. Because when you are faithful, God can do amazing things. Now, you remember about 3 weeks ago, Pastor Jeff Walling was here. And I don't know if you remember that he preached on Matthew chapter 1. Remember the genealogy? You never thought that you could hear a good sermon on Jesus' genealogy? And it's a good sermon, right? So don't skip over those names when you read through the Bible. And it's fantastic. You know what's really cool? When you look at Matthew chapter 1, verse 6, you know what's really cool? Like, David and Bathsheba are in Jesus' genealogy. The same people that made this horrible mistake, especially David, who went on this long chain of bad decisions, giving in to temptation after temptation after temptation. God put him at the center of the genealogy. Now, here's something for those of you who are Bible nerds. Where are my Bible nerds? You're out there somewhere. Like, here's a nerd nugget for you, okay? Like, Matthew chapter 1, verse 17, it says, thus there were 14 generations in all from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile in Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Messiah. 14, 14, 14. You see, in Greek and Hebrew, each of these languages, each letter has a numeric value. Do you know the numeric value of David's name? It's 14. He is the center of this genealogy. And when you read Matthew, you know what Jesus is called over and over again? Son of David, son of David, have mercy on me, son of David, son of David, son of David. Don't tell me that God can't use you. It is never too late to return. It is never too late to accept Jesus. Never, as long as you have breath in your lungs. I'm already over a little bit, so I'm going to end here real quick. I got to tell you this. Some of you know my story, some of you don't. Okay, when I was 2 years old, my parents were both professors in Columbia, Missouri. And when they got a divorce, when I was two, my mom and dad both went into gay and lesbian relationships. My mom was in a lesbian relationship with a woman named Vera for 22 years. She was a psychologist, Vera was, until she died. They were together for 22 years until she died. My dad had several different friends. My mom and Vera moved to Kansas City, home of the greatest football team in the nation. Just saying. Should go look at my Instagram. Put something on there on new Raider Stadium. They have a new retractable roof. I'll leave it right there. You just go take a look. My mom and Vera, they were activists. My dad was an activist. I was raised in an activist environment. When I was growing up, like preschool, elementary age, middle school, my parents took me with them to clubs and bars and hangouts and house parties and pride parades. And I remember this one pride parade I marched in. There were quote-unquote Christians on the sidelines holding up signs saying, God hates you, throwing water and urine on people. And as a young kid, I looked at my mom. I said, why are they acting like that? And she said, well, Caleb, they're Christians. Christians don't like gay people. If you're not like them, they will not like you. And I saw that proved time and time again. I saw Christian families ignoring their young sons, dying of AIDS in the 1980s, not wanting to touch them or anything. Here's what I thought. If Christians are this bad, I don't want to be one because I can't imagine how awful Jesus is. And so by the time I was 16, I was sneaking out at night, living it up, like my hair was down to here, like back then. And this is not a roast. I understand the Lord taketh away, but like when I walked out here, some of you are probably like, who put Dudley in a dryer with a wet towel? I hated Christians. I got invited when I was 16 to this Bible study, and I thought, I'm going to go and be a pretend Christian, a ninja Christian, and I'm going to destroy their faith. As you can tell, that turned out real well. It's a great plan. But here's what I learned, that Jesus had very deep theological convictions. He had very real relationships with people that the pastors of his day would have nothing to do with. And I was like, I can get on board with that. And I kept on reading, and I came to a couple of conclusions that I still hold today. The first one is this. I believe that God designed sexual intimacy and affection to be expressed in a marriage between one man and one woman. But I also believe that our theological beliefs should never be reasons to devalue another human being. That I have many friends who are living together and not married. I have friends who are in same-sex relationships and so on, and they know my theological beliefs, but you know what? I love them, we're friends, because this belief over here has never stopped me from loving somebody over here, period. And so then I had to come out at the age of 16 as a Christian to my three activist gay parents. And when I did, they kicked me out of the house. As they said, now you're like those people. And I had to stay with my different friends and different youth groups. And eventually, they let me back in. And I went to Bible college, was on staff here for 11 years, moved out to Dallas, Texas for 3.5 years. Everybody's got to live in purgatory at some point. I mean, it's a hostile environment. You got Mark Cuban there and Jerry Jones, and it's flat, humid, snakes, and just everything. And so when I was there preaching the church, my mom and dad moved down there separately of one another to start attending my church. My mom's partner had died, and she was going through depression. She moved down there. Then they said, we want to be with you, around your family. Can we start attending your church? And I said, yes. And at the ages of 69, 70, my mom and dad gave their lives to Jesus Christ. Why do I say that? Because it is never too late. God is always faithful. Temptation never keeps its promises. It will always seek to destroy you. But God is always faithful, and he will always be there to pick you up. And it is never too late to do the right thing. And even if you think it's too late to do the right thing, you have to ask yourself, what is the wise thing to do? I want you guys to stand with me. I'm gonna pray in a minute. And after I pray, you guys are dismissed. But after I pray, I just wanna put this invitation out there. If there are some of you, you have never named Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, I want you to come up here and go over to these doors all the way over there to my left and to your right, right over there where it says exit. There are gonna be people ready to pray for you. If you wanna ask questions about Jesus, if you have never made the decision to get baptized, what is stopping you? Like, today is a perfect day to do it. There's some of you, you've been off track and you need to get back on track. And maybe people don't even know you've been off track, but you need to get over there. Others of you, you just need prayer. I'm gonna pray, and then again, you'll be dismissed. But again, if you feel that pull, that tug, do not resist God. He's there for you, he's faithful, he's waiting. Let me pray for you. Lord, thank you so much that you are faithful. Thank you for revealing to us the fact that temptation is not faithful. Please save us from ourselves, Father. We do not make good decisions on our own. We look for opportunities to insert our own agenda. Help us, Father, to be able to walk in your ways. And please be there when we do mess up. Help us not to be afraid to look in the mirror and take responsibility. Father, I love you. It's in your son's name I pray. Amen. God bless you. Love you. Take care, guys. We'll see you.